From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Japanese health officials say they've confirmed 88 more cases of COVID-19 in that quarantined cruise ship docked near Tokyo. The new cases bring the total on the Diamond Princess to 544. More than 300 Americans who were on that ship are now back in the U.S., and at least 14 tested positive for the illness caused by the new coronavirus. Joining us now is CNN international correspondent Will Ripley, who is in Yokohama, Japan, the port where the Diamond Princess is. Will, are there still any Americans on that ship?
There are, and we've been in communication with some of them. One of them is Kent Frazier from Oregon, whose wife, Rebecca, is in the hospital in Tokyo. She tested positive for coronavirus. She was not allowed on the evacuation flights, even though she wanted desperately to get on so she could ride out the 14-day quarantine in the U.S. with her husband. But because she's still testing positive, they're not allowing her out of the hospital. They didn't allow her on that flight. And so Kent is still on the ship as we speak.
And how is he doing amid all of that?
Well, you know, I think he's okay. I think it's frustrating that he's still separated from his wife. But incredibly, even though they were in such close proximity, he still does not have the virus. And he's been tested at least three times.
Now, as you watch the process for Americans who were able to leave and fly home yesterday after spending so long quarantined on that ship, what did you see?
It was confusing how long it took. I mean, you're talking about nearly 10 hours from the time that people started to disembark and from the time they actually started boarding those converted cargo 747s at Haneda Airport, which is only about a 20-minute drive away from the port. The reason for the delay, unclear, although given the fact that we've now learned that 14 Americans who had basically been released from the ship and were sitting on the American buses only to then learn as they were on the buses that they were also positive. Mm-hmm. That may be why there was a delay, because they were trying to figure out what to do with these people. In the end, they decided to allow them on the flights and put them in these kind of containment areas inside the plane, kept in isolation from the other passengers.
So most of the Americans are off the ship. I understand a number of other countries are also getting their people off the ship. How many people are left on the Diamond Princess?
Well, still, you know, around 3,000 people, perhaps a little bit less at this stage. But, you know, you have Canada repatriating its citizens in the coming hours. You have South Korea. They sent their presidential plane to pick up their citizens. Italy, Australia, a lot of other countries are following suit, kind of following the lead of the U.S.
Is there criticism of how Japanese officials have handled the people on that ship? Many are saying, you know, this may have served as an incubator for the coronavirus.
Even the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has said that people who are on the ship face a higher risk of infection. And it makes a lot of sense. The Japanese were very, very strict with, you know, insisting that everybody stay in their cabins, or if they did leave their cabins, they go outside very, very infrequently for less than an hour and stand 6 feet apart from others, always wear a mask. But that didn't seem to take account the fact that you still have, you know, 1,000 crew members who are cooking their food, doing their laundry, and like bringing all of these things to different cabins, potentially spreading the virus that way, because, you know, they really don't know how long it can live on a surface, or it can live on, you know, for a towel, for example, or bedding. And some of the crew members have become infected. So from the beginning, it was kind of a flawed theory that if everybody just stayed in their cabins, they wouldn't become infected. And I think that's obviously being proven by the fact that every single day you see these large spikes in the number of confirmed cases on board, mm-hmm. because the Japanese government has finally decided to test everybody. For a while, they said they weren't even going to test everyone. They were only going to test people with a fever.
Although there are now concerns about the other cruise ship that was finally able to dock in Cambodia and then allow the passengers off. And now one of the passengers there tested positive for COVID-19.
The Westerdam. That's right. Yeah. I mean, look, if you think about an outbreak and you think about a virus, it's very, very difficult to contain the spread because people are people. Somebody's not going to report their fever. Somebody's going to get around whatever safeguards are set up. But clearly, in the case of the Diamond Princess here in Japan, it certainly isn't slowing the number of cases from continuing to increase. You know, the fact that you have 88 new cases today, 99 yesterday, 70 the day before, 67 the day before that. Those are numbers you just can't ignore.
Will, because of the threat from COVID-19, the Tokyo Marathon scheduled for March the 1st is only going to allow elite runners to participate. More than 35,000 regular runners are not going to be able to run. And the Olympics, of course, are coming up in Tokyo this summer. What about the broader concern where you are in Japan about COVID-19?
Well, certainly there is an economic impact from the marathon, but really what they're worried about is Tokyo 2020. Scientists have said that this virus doesn't do very well in warmer temperatures, and I think Japanese authorities are certainly hoping that that turns out to be the case because they have invested billions of dollars in this. Tokyo 2020, this country's most important sporting event, in decades. And yes, I think the decision to dramatically scale back the marathon is because they don't want to see any more cases in this country. The fact that Japan has the largest concentration of cases anywhere in the world outside of mainland China is a difficult situation for Japan just months ahead of the Olympics. And frankly, the way that they've handled this cruise ship situation raises a lot of credibility questions about their assurances that the games are going to be safe.
That is CNN international correspondent Will Ripley in Yokohama, Japan, where the Diamond Princess cruise ship remains with thousands of people on board. Will, thank you.
Great to be with you.
The Boy Scouts of America's national organization has filed for bankruptcy as it faces several hundred lawsuits from men who say they were sexually abused by scoutmasters and other leaders when they were youth members. In a statement, the 110-year-old organization said it made the filing in order to compensate victims who were harmed during their time in scouting. We're joined now by Michael Pfau. He's an attorney representing several former scouts. Welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Michael, how will this bankruptcy filing impact your cases?
Well, it's going to have an enormous impact on the cases. We presently represent 300 former scouts across the country with high concentrations in California and New York. And those cases are filed or were to be filed in state court. The cases against the Boy Scouts will be stayed or halted, and then ultimately transferred to bankruptcy court in Delaware.
And this is an important distinction because you actually have said that you wanted, your clients wanted, to be able to tell their stories in court.
Yeah, in that sense, it will really, I think, have the most profound difference. For most of the abuse survivors we represent in Boy Scout cases and other cases, holding the institution accountable, and after years, sometimes of decades of silence, being able to tell their story is really of the utmost importance. Now, that said, when a bankruptcy like this occurs, certainly our clients' legal rights are not extinguished. They'll be compensated through the bankruptcy process, and also we try real hard to give them a voice in the proceeding, and that's something that's very important to us.
Have you had a chance to speak to any of them, and how are they reacting to this news?
We have, and we've also been heavily involved in a number of the Catholic bankruptcies, so we've been through this process before, and it's pretty typical for the abuse survivors we represent at first to be angry because it's viewed as a legal ploy or a legal tool used by the Boy Scouts to avoid really fully being exposed. But after initially being angry and frustrated, most of the people we represent treat this with resolve. They realize that they still have a case. They still have a story to be told. It'll just be told in a different format.
You mentioned the Catholic Church. There have been several laws passed in several states, including New York and California, that allow a temporary window for cases barred by the statute of limitations. And you've also said that the number of claims you believe will eclipse those of the Catholic Church. How so?
Well, there's no question about that. The Boy Scout bankruptcy is historic in size and scope. We know that there were thousands of perpetrators in the Boy Scouts in all 50 states in the American territories, and tens of thousands of victims. So the bankruptcy courts or the courts in the United States have never seen anything of this size or magnitude before. And that's why it will eclipse any of the Catholic bankruptcies that we've seen.
The Boy Scouts of America recently named a new president, and he's been very vocal about wanting potential victims to speak up and share their stories. They've also said this bankruptcy will allow the Boy Scouts to create a victims' compensation trust, allowing for equitable compensation to the victims. Do you see value in the Scouts continuing on as an activity for children? Do you believe it's worth saving?
You know, that's a really, really good question. And, you know, ironically, I was a Boy Scout. If they emerge from this in some sort of viable form, and they probably will, It is at least our sincere hope that when they emerge, they will be a transparent organization. They will warn parents and children about the dangers of abuse and scouting, and will be a better organization. From someone who has advocated for Scout victims for decades, that has not been the case historically. This is really a day of reckoning for the Boy Scouts. And, you know, one thing I would point out is if there are abuse survivors listening, they still very much have legal rights against the Boy Scouts and against their local council. And those rights will not be extinguished.
That's Michael Pfau, an attorney representing several former Boy Scouts who filed suit against the Boy Scouts of America for sexual abuse. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
If I say Sarah Jessica Parker, you probably think Sex and the City.
There is a good way to break up with someone, and it doesn't include a Post-it.
When I say Matthew Broderick, perhaps you think of the 1986 film Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he fakes being sick to get out of school.
It's a little childish and stupid, but then so is high school. Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Well, Broderick and Parker have been married for more than 20 years, and now, for the first time since their wedding, they're in a play together. It's a new production of Neil Simon's Plaza Suite. They're trying out the show in Boston before taking it to Broadway. I sat down with them before a rehearsal at the Emerson Colonial Theater. Sarah Jessica Parker and Matthew Broderick, welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I can't believe I'm on Here and Now.
It's great to have you on Here and Now.
Love Here and Now.
How does it feel to be doing a stage production together for the first time in a couple of decades, right?
Yes, and this feels very much its own unique, brand new experience because we're working on something from the very beginning. And it's like walking into a room with a brand new colleague. It's all possibility and all potential, but that is as terrifying as anything.
Matthew, what about you?
You know, to make these parts that we've seen others do, to make them our own, it's been a long and really fun experience and really a lot of laughs, actually. And, you know, if you're married, you're best friends, whatever, when you're start rehearsal, you're kind of strangers in a way. You don't really know what the other's going to bring to the part or what you're going to bring, and you have to meet and figure out how it all goes together, how it marries, yeah. So it's like any play in a way.
What about the idea of doing a play about love and marriage right now when so many marriages end up in divorce? It seems almost old-fashioned.
I remember when divorce hit my neighborhood in like 1971, and it like went through like a serious flu. Like
the first play of these three plays is sort of about a marriage that seems to be ending, or you're not sure if it is, but
it's in crisis.
Yeah,
and they are very much a product of their generation and the way that they're dealing with
it. She's at home, you know. There's some things about it that are very different now, but there's always. You know, even if you do something that was written in, you know, medieval time, I mean, it's things change on the surface, but human beings and what goes on between them has been going on for a...
What about the Neil Simon connection? This is, I think, your sixth Neil Simon production?
I think it is, yeah. I've always been drawn to him. I mean, before I was an actor, I liked watching, you know, the TV show of The Odd Couple, which he didn't write, but... was his idea, and the movie I loved. And even in acting school, people were always giving me, you know, Neil Simon scenes and Come Blow Your Horn or whatever. And I just feel lucky to have. I didn't ever mean it to be that I would work with him or get to this many times. He wrote a sequel to the first play, so that turned into two. They made a movie of one of those, so it turned into three. Mm-hmm. My first movie he wrote. Then I did The Odd Couple. Now, I don't know. I don't know how it happened, but I'm amazed that I've been in two Neil Simon movies and four Neil Simon plays.
What do you think he would think about the fact that the two of you are doing Plaza Suite now?
I think he would be delighted. you know, and occasionally enraged, but then not really. But he, you know, he took this stuff very seriously. He'd be very helpful if he was here too. He'd be.
I think if he was witness
to
honestly what's happening here at the theater, meaning the audience is response.
He could not be happy with that. It's impossible.
I think that he would be. It meant so much to him, these audiences, and there's a reason we wanted to come to Boston. There's a reason we wanted to be in Boston. It's the role that Boston has traditionally played in the road to Broadway, and they are discerning, smart audiences, and there's a reason Neil wanted to be here. So knowing all that and working so hard to get here, I think, never mind us, the experience the audience is having, their delight, I think, would have made Neil very happy.
Do you prefer to get that reaction from the audience as opposed to doing television or cinema when you don't see how people are reacting exactly?
Well, he works in the theater much more than I do. I just don't think there's any...
You've done quite a bit of it yourself, so...
Yes, but yeah. I just don't think there is any comparison for an actor than being on a stage. It's an actor's medium. There's no one editing your work later. There's no one interpreting it. There's no audience later telling you what you did 6 months, 8 months, 12 months after you've been on a set and done 20 takes, 17 takes, one take, nine takes. Like, right?
Yeah.
And it, but it's equally as heartbreaking when it isn't working, you know, to be on a stage and not have a reaction from an audience is as painful as is the extraordinary, you know, so it's a massive gamble. It's the, it's what separates the wheat from the, is it
chaff, isn't it?
Chaff?
I don't know. I'm an actor.
I want to ask each of you just about what our listeners probably know you most for, or some of them anyway. Sarah Jessica Parker, obviously, Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City, a show that we were thinking about it. It was influential both in portrayal of female friendship, fashion. It probably encouraged a lot of people to move to New York, young women especially.
That's what I hear, yeah.
What do you think is the legacy of that show?
Well, I'm not good at answering this because I try not to be somebody that's academic about the show, or it sounds like
that's
I've spent a lot of time.
For, Sarah,
but then I feel embarrassed, like it sounds like I've spent a lot of time thinking about the legacy of the show rather than just my good fortune to have been part of something that even gets asked a question. But I guess what I, if forced to answer, I would say that I think there's a few probably important little pieces that it's left. The first is that we got to take sort of the history and amazing work of Mary Tyler Moore and Marlo Thomas and some other great women who were telling stories of being single. And we got to be on a network that allowed for language and environment and circumstances to be simply different. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I think that the writers were very smart and not, they didn't exploit that. So it changed the way women spoke to each other, and it changed the way television looked at female relationships and sexual politics. I think it also, like when I walk down the street now, I see groups of four women, or I see on Sunday groups of four or five women sitting and having brunch, and I recognize that as some tiny
came
little
from that show,
thing
you think?
Of those friendships and the idea of your friends are your family and the kind of commitment and investment you make in those relationships.
And Matthew Broderick, I have to say that I grew up in Illinois in the 1980s.
Oh, my.
And could probably recite all of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I've seen it so many times. I hear that you say that people still come up to you and say, Ferris, is this your day off?
Yeah, less, but yeah, it still happens. It always amazes me.
Well, what do you think was the impact of that film? Why did you know when you made it that it would have such a lasting impact?
No, certainly not. John Hughes, though, was already very, very successful. Like, I remember they called him the Spielberg of teen movies or something like that when I first got sent that script. I think he had such a really great, simple idea that seemed to I mean, which did resonate, you know. I remember he had kind of a mock-up of the poster before we even made the movie, which said Leisure Rules on it, that a teenager could like leisure in a sort of adult way. And
he was from advertising.
Oh, really?
So in a way, he started with the ad and then he filled in the movie.
Well, like, you really think conceptually, which is a very different way of working. Some condemn it because you're like, oh, you're backing into now the end. But as an audience of every John Hughes movie, every single one, I paid for every single one, sometimes twice, he understood what we wanted to see. And it makes so much sense that he came from advertising. Don't you think?
Yeah, definitely.
He's very good at what he did. Nobody also.
Well, he was a very.
How about all his costume and production design? Like, the values were so big in his movies, don't you think?
Absolutely.
So finally, and I know that you have to get back to rehearsal here for this show.
Nah, not really.
Do you still get nervous on stage?
Yes.
Before. If they would simply just remove the rest of your day and just let you just wake you up. Put you on stage.
But imagine actually how awful that would actually be to come to and be like,
no.
Oh my God, I'm on stage.
Just this part. It's once a show is open and running and you're in a not a mind-numbing, don't care routine, but these are early days for us still, you know, and I mean, the truth is it just means you just still care, which after almost 40 freaking... I mean, sometimes like, why do I care? Why do I
care? Well, if this goes well, you could both make a career out of this, too.
Oh, true.
Let's hope. Fingers crossed.
Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker, stars of the new production of the Neil Simon play Plaza Suite. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, the show is playing in Boston before heading to Broadway next month. Details at hereandnow.org.
A flash flood watch continues throughout central Mississippi and parts of Alabama. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves has declared a state of emergency, calling the floods historic. Hundreds of homes and buildings have been damaged, and people are still evacuating. Joining us now with the latest is Justin Vickery, reporter for the Jackson Clarion Ledger. And Justin, tell us what you're seeing. How bad is it?
It's not as bad as it was initially expected. It was the Pearl River was expected to crest at 38 feet. That's about 11 feet above its normal flood stage. It's actually, right now, it's at 36.3, but it's still, even at that level, it's the third highest flood in history. So it's had a pretty dramatic effect on the community, especially those neighborhoods near the Pearl River. You know, it's not as bad as it could have been, but it's pretty devastating to a lot of families.
Can you give us perspective there? The Pearl River, there are lots of neighborhoods surrounding the Pearl River. Where is the damage the worst?
Sure.
And what's the main concern right now?
Yeah, well, the damage is definitely the worst in Northeast Jackson. The Pearl kind of meanders through the city, and that's the closest neighborhood, and it's the lowest lying neighborhood, and most of those homes were built in the 60s. Now, that was before the biggest flood we've ever seen, which is 1979, the Easter flood, and that inundated virtually the entire downtown area as well as much of the city. But with the level where the Pearl's at now, say close to 300 homes in the neighborhood have been inundated by floodwaters. Right now, one of the issues we have is the forecast calls for rain. In fact, it's raining right now. So that's not helping. The city has had an issue with flash flooding as well. January, we saw the second highest amount of rainfall ever. So that's caused a lot of flash flooding. So you can imagine a lot of residents are just pretty sick of the water.
Yeah, and I know that flash flooding, as you said, is a huge concern, just looking at the hours and the days ahead. What about the wider region? There are also reports of heavy rain in Louisiana and Mississippi, where you are, but Alabama and Georgia as well. So if people are trying to escape there, they may not get much relief, I'm just thinking. How many people have left Jackson to wait out this storm?
Right, right. Great question. Well, we're still trying to get the official number of the homes that have been affected. You know, the Jackson Police Department and the mayor's office did a pretty good job as far as putting out the word of these mandatory evacuations. And they did that with a sense of the history of the region and its history of flooding. And so a lot of people responded to that. Consider there's probably about, you know, roughly 1,000 people have been evacuated. I was on a fan boat with the mayor yesterday, and we went through some of these neighborhoods, and as flooded as they were, there were quite a few people in kayaks and canoes just sitting out in front of their properties, you know, protecting the possessions and just kind of uncertain of what to do.
Yeah. That's Justin Vickery, reporter for the Jackson Clarion Ledger. Thank you so much for this update.
Sure.
A new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out today puts Bernie Sanders in first place nationally among Democrats running for president and Michael Bloomberg in second place, which means Bloomberg will take part in his first 2020 debate tomorrow night in Nevada, where caucuses will be held in just 4 days. And it's where we find NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who joins us now from Las Vegas. Hi, Tam.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we've also got with us NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro in Washington. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
So let's start with this poll, Domenico. It shows Bernie Sanders with 31% support nationally. Bloomberg, who isn't on the ballot in Nevada, is at 19% in this national poll. What does that tell you?
Well, Bernie Sanders really opened up a pretty big lead here, a double-digit lead. And some of what a lot of people have talked about with Sanders is whether he can expand his coalition. You know, he does very well with people under 45. He does well in cities. But there's been question about how much of a ceiling he has. But in this poll, he's doing well in a cross-section with a cross-section of voters. It also tells you all that money that Michael Bloomberg has spent, the former New York mayor, some $300 million of his own money on advertisements, that is really broken through. He's leapfrogged Joe Biden, the former vice president, who's at 15%. Elizabeth Warren continues her slide. She's only at 12%. And notably, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, who had very good showings in the first two states in single digits with 9 and 8% respectively.
Well, and Tam, does that mean that tomorrow night Bloomberg is going to have the target on his back, maybe instead of Bernie Sanders, who obviously won in New Hampshire and won the popular vote in Iowa?
Well, it's the first time that Bloomberg will be on a debate stage, which means that he's likely to get a little bit of an initiation, if you will. And certainly in the lead up to this debate, even before we knew that he would be on the stage, the other Democratic candidates were going after him for various things. Bernie Sanders saying that, you know, voters don't want a billionaire buying an election. And Bloomberg has gone after Sanders. You know, the interesting thing about the way this race is shaping up is that in some ways, you know, there is a Bernie Sanders lane and there is an everyone else lane. Mm-hmm. And Bernie Sanders has, you know, 31%. He is leading in our poll. And Michael Bloomberg is trying to be the other lane. He's trying to sort of elbow out all these people who have been campaigning for months and months and months and just sort of jump ahead using all that money to supercharge and sort of bypass the typical early state momentum.
Well, and what about that other lane, the moderate lane, if you will? Domenico, Joe Biden did not do well in either Iowa or New Hampshire. Is Nevada make or break for him? Does he have to get in at least the top three there?
I'd say it's South Carolina where he really needs to do well. You know, Nevada is about 41% non-white, about 13% African-American from 2016, 19% Latino. Bernie Sanders has had pretty good strength we've seen so far with Latino voters, especially voters under 45 of color. Bernie Sanders does quite well. South Carolina, 61% African-American in 2016. Joe Biden has been continuing to talk about how African-Americans are his base, that he does quite well with them. If he doesn't win South Carolina, it's very hard to see what his path forward is.
I was talking to a Biden surrogate over the weekend who said that he needs a strong performance in Nevada and a win in South Carolina. I asked what a strong performance in Nevada was, and talk about lowering expectations. This surrogate said, well, you know, anything that shows momentum, anything better than New Hampshire. Biden finished fifth in New Hampshire.
Right. So it's a low bar to clear.
Well,
for
they're
Biden.
Setting the bar kind of right. low for Nevada.
What about Pete Buttigieg, who won Iowa, came in second in New Hampshire? Here he is speaking in Las Vegas yesterday.
This is our chance, our only chance, to bring new thinking to Washington and flush out what this president has brought with him before it's too late. We can't go up against the most disruptive president in American history, both by falling back on the familiar.
Tam, this NPR poll out today is not good for him. Only 8% support nationally. What does he need to do in the debate tomorrow, and what does he need to prove in Nevada?
You know, Pete Buttigieg is essentially trying to say, hey, I won Iowa, or came very tied, whatever we call it in Iowa, you know, came very close in New Hampshire. He is trying to be the not Bernie Sanders candidate, to try to say, I'm the one who is, you know, the other alternative. But he has not shown yet that he can perform well in a more diverse state. And you know, our polling indicates that he does not do well with voters of color. So what he has to prove in Nevada is that he can do well with an electorate that is more reflective of the Democratic electorate more broadly nationwide. And if he can't, then he's going to have a hard time arguing that he's the one who's the alternative to Bernie Sanders for Democrats.
Well, doesn't Amy Klobuchar face the same problem with voters of color? She had a strong third place finish in New Hampshire. Here she is in an interview in Las Vegas.
We see ourselves on an upward path. I never thought I was going to be able to compete with some of my opponent's bank accounts. But what I don't have in that, I have made up in hard work. We've got teams now in every Super Tuesday state.
Domenico, what's Amy Klobuchar's path forward over the next couple of weeks?
You know, she needs to really show in Nevada and South Carolina, like Tam was saying with Buttigieg, she needs to be able to show Klobuchar that she can make some improvements and show some inroads with voters of color. Because right now in our polling, she only gets about 4% of African Americans overall. That's just not going to cut it when it comes to trying to win the Democratic nomination, which is a very diverse party. And especially heading into Super Tuesday, March 3rd, you have 14 states that are going to be holding contests. You know, you've got to be able to have wide support. There's more than a third of the vote, more than a third of the delegates up on that day. And, you know, you can't come out the other side of that in, you know, fourth or fifth place or even third place, frankly.
By the way, that day is 2 weeks from today, which is unbelievable because there's going to be a lot between now and then. What about Elizabeth Warren? She came in a distant fourth in New Hampshire, third place in Iowa. Tam, do you expect her to go after any of her rivals tomorrow, or is what kind of a situation is she in?
You know, I saw her last night at an event at a grocery store in East Las Vegas. She has no voice. She has completely lost her voice. She's been suffering from a cold, and she hasn't slowed down her campaigning. And she just doesn't have a voice. So one question for the debate is how she is going to sort of push through the physical limitations right now. A lot of her supporters are very frustrated that she currently is number three in the delegate count after the first two states. And yet she's not getting the same attention as some of the other candidates who aren't even doing as well as she is. But, you know, there is this sense of the air having come out of the balloon, that the momentum is moving in the wrong direction. And this grocery store event last night in a heavily Latino community, she was energetic. The folks there were energetic, but it was a really small group of people.
You know, she really has to surprise in Nevada and South Carolina. She's being squeezed on both ends, with white college-educated voters who started to trickle away from her toward Pete Buttigieg, possibly Amy Klobuchar even, and progressives. You know, she has been polling second behind Bernie Sanders with progressives the entire time, and she just has not been able to walk that line. She still has a very strong organization. They're hoping that that organization can show her doing better than signs are pointing to right now.
You know, an interesting point was made today, which is that the two people at the top of this poll that NPR just came out with, that would be Sanders and Bloomberg, don't actually have a long history as Democrats. Sanders is an independent. Bloomberg switched his party registration to Republican and independent to run for mayor of New York, then back to Democrat to run for president. Domenico, your thoughts?
Well, look, you know, there's this toggle between beating Trump as the priority versus whether people agree with you on the issues. And Bernie Sanders really plays to progressives in a way where you've had a lot of progressive Democrats, more independent-minded, sort of very liberal, thinking that the establishment Democrats haven't done what they're supposed to do and sort of blame them almost for Donald Trump being in office. And then you have Bloomberg, who's this outsider who can spend all of this money, who is also not tied to the establishment. And frankly, I have to say, in watching these campaign events, being to a bunch of them in Iowa, they didn't really talk a lot about being Democrats and what Democrats do. And I think that there is a potential crack up that is potentially threatened by a Sanders-Bloomberg bout after Super Tuesday.
Jeremy, let me just add that there is just nothing normal about this primary.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me what you were going to put your money on there on the casinos in Vegas, Tamara.
I don't gamble. Definitely not on politics.
Tamara Keith and Domenico Montanaro, thanks to both of you.
Always on black.
Thank you.
Oregon lawmakers are debating how to meet the needs of some 14,000 homeless people in the state. There's now a bill on the table that would pay local governments and nonprofits to build homeless shelters and waive some zoning restrictions. But some cities are concerned about giving up local control, and they say waiving zoning restrictions might lead to shelters being built in areas far away from amenities like medical care. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the city of Eugene, Oregon, is also feeling the pressure from local business owners who want the city to come up with its own solutions.
The Elkhorn Brewery has contended with litter, theft, and discarded needles since it opened 5 years ago. But owner Stephen Sheehan says this past year was the worst. A homeless woman vandalized his place and the Thai restaurant next door twice in the span of a month.
She broke our windows, our front door, and Manola's. 3 weeks after that time, then she tried to light Molotov cocktails. She broke out 12 windows, the doors, $8,000 worth of damage.
Angry and frustrated, she had formed a coalition called Eugene Wake Up. Its membership includes more than 100 small business owners who, like Sheehan, say they are tired of vandalism and disruptive behavior, often from transients.
We just can't do this anymore. It's killing us as a community. It's killing us as a business community. Something has to be done immediately, and that's the reason or purpose for our group.
Sheehan and his group have taken their gripes to city leaders, including their complaint that in Eugene's liberal, inclusive, counterculture climate, officials prioritize homeless concerns over business concerns and do not hold homeless people accountable when they commit crimes. Police Chief Chris Skinner says he supports Eugene Wake Up's proactive approach, but he says it's also important business owners know that criminal behavior is police priority.
It's not illegal to loiter downtown. It's not illegal to exist downtown. It's illegal to be downtown and engage in criminal behavior.
Skinner says downtown Eugene is heavily policed, and there are plans to put more officers on the streets.
I can't reiterate enough that your police department is an active and engaged member of this community that wants to help solve this problem, but that's not where this problem gets solely solved.
Would you like a receipt?
At Eugene's Friendly Street Market, tension has eased after a serial vandal was recently apprehended after breaking in the front door 3 times. Owner Aaron Gaffillin says that's why groups like Eugene Wake Up are needed.
Over a number of years, we've had issues with people sleeping here, going to the bathroom here. We found needles around. There has to be a solution reached. I think that it's just going to get worse and worse and worse until there's some kind of breaking point.
Many business owners say they also feel targeted by some community members if they complain about criminal acts by transients, as if they're condemning all homeless for the actions of a few.
When they first came out, I did feel that way, and I have interacted with Eugene Wake Up members, and I have a different view now.
Arwen Mosta Spain is executive director of Carry It Forward, a homelessness support group in Eugene. She says some business owners concern her, but most are able to differentiate between homelessness and lawlessness, and she wants to work with them.
Businesses and organizations like mine could be collaborating to create more spaces for homeless people to live and have support services while they are also providing the business with some kind of on-site security or cleanup efforts. Those could be immediate collaborations.
Across the street from the Elkhorn Brewery, panhandler St. Christopher Bonnell sits under an umbrella with his dog. He worries that this new coalition of businesses could be the latest phase of a trend he's seen in Eugene over the last 10 years.
This place is being gentrified, pure and simple. It's being gentrified. It's being taken over by the cleanup crew, is what I'd call it.
Bonnell worries that if the city isn't careful, the push to clean up Eugene could divide it instead.
Honestly, I just would like to have the people that are going to be deciding this to have common sense. Just have common sense. Don't pinpoint people, because all you're gonna do is cause you're gonna cause just a divide. And why would you want to divide a community? Why don't you bring it together? Like, just bring it together. Don't try to divide it any more than it already is.
Outside the overhead door company of Eugene Springfield, President Paul Burrell stares at a row of homeless tents and carts that obscure his roadside sign. Staff and customers have dealt with transients entering their offices and yelling at them, or leaving trash and waste. While Burrell's patience is running short, he still holds out hope and compassion.
We do support the people who do want to get help. We think there is a big need for behavioral health, mental health funding. We just don't have the resources to help the people who are trying to help themselves and get work and be healthy, versus the people who are consistently not wanting to help, just being lawless individuals.
Some members of Eugene Wake Up say they're reviewing their options in a city that ranks first nationally for homelessness. If things don't improve, some business owners say they may move on to other cities or back political candidates here who would support their agenda. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.